Neither snow nor rain nor heat nor gloom of night stays these couriers from the swift completion of their appointed rounds.
Biggest retail business in the world today is the United States Post Office, devoted exclusively to the service of its owners, the American public. Though 90% of its income is derived from the sale of stamps, the Post Office is also the largest savings bank in the country and the largest agency for the transfer of money. It takes in more than $1.5 billion annually. Postal business is transacted through some 47,000 post offices, contract stations, and branches in 42,000 U.S. communities.
Thank you, as always, to our over-caffeinated sponsors and members of all tiers for supporting our work. Please go to unftr.com to learn more about our membership tiers, to sign up for our free weekly newsletter, or to access our directory of progressive resources. And now, enjoy the show.
U to the N to the FTR. I'm fucking the Republic, beating people where they are. Left, right, center, make you laugh, make you cry. Max brings the heat of a basic white guy.
That's me.
Could have run for office, could have got up off his ass.
Hey.
Could have made something other than a fucking podcast. But here we are, yo. The UNFTR show. Many faces ripping the script with fuckers around the globe. Fuckers on Canuckers, you're a fuckers 99. I'm the fuckers and some fuckers, they all like they fucking minds. From New York to Outagami, Halifax to New Zealand. Say it loud, say it with me, yo, fuck Milton Friedman.
Chapter 1, The Old Post Office.
The U.S. Postal Service is one of the most derided institutions in the country. It's been lampooned on television through characters like Cliff Clavin, Cleveland Brown, Newman. Phrases like going postal and snail mail are in the American lexicon. And of course,
just about everybody works in a post office as an alien.
Also, the USPS is the most beloved government agency in the country. By like a lot. According to Pew Research, the USPS blows away every other government agency with a 91% favorability rating. Pew, Harris, Gallup, every polling agency agrees on this ranking. Now, don't get me wrong, customer reviews are mostly atrocious. There's a serious disconnect in the American mind when it comes to the post office. We grumble and poke fun, let our dogs bark and chase mail carriers, thumb our noses at the government attitude and say things like, our tax dollars at work. At the same time, we're strangely proud of this institution. It's like someone picking on your sister or your hometown. It's okay for you to do it, but if someone else does it, watch out. Somewhere, deep down, I think we all recognize what a fucking miracle it is that you can stuff a piece of paper in an envelope, write a couple of words on it, drop it in a giant blue metal box, and voila! A day or two later, a loved one is reading a Mother's Day card, or a company is receiving a check. Even in our cynical and increasingly digital world where technological miracles abound, there's a deep and abiding respect for the United States Postal Service. Even if everyone that works there is an alien. Here are some additional fun facts about the post office before we get to the heart of the matter.
In 2023, the Postal Service delivered to 154 million residential addresses.
The Postal Service has 22,873 leased properties.
The Postal Service owns 8,500 properties.
In 2023, the Postal Service paid $2.03 billion every 2 weeks in salaries and benefits.
44% of the mail volume worldwide is processed and delivered by the USPS.
The Postal Service accepted 8.6 million passport applications in 2023 alone.
There were 525,469 career employees in 2023.
The number of non-career employees was 115,000.
The Postal Service has more than 246,503 vehicles, one of the largest civilian fleets in the world.
In 2023, the Postal Service issued 63.3 million money orders. That's roughly 209,000 money orders each day.
The Postal Service had $78.2 billion in operating revenue in 2023.
Now, the Post Office dates back to 1792 as an official department. But none other than Benjamin Franklin served as the first Postmaster General under the Second Continental Congress in 1775. demonstrating how important it was to the young nation, the post office was then enshrined in Article 1 of the Constitution.
Article 1, Section 8, Clause 7 reads, "The Congress shall have power to establish post offices and post roads."
Well, that was a lot. First major point, establishing post offices is an enumerated power of Congress in the Constitution. So put that under your hat for a bit. The only debate over these powers over the next 100 years or so was the extent to which the post office was able to create and maintain post roads, a power that was eventually superseded and clarified in subsequent decisions. Nearly a century later, it was established as a cabinet-level department with the Postmaster General reporting directly to the President of the United States. While Congress has the authority to fund the post office because it can pretty much fund anything it wants, the post office is actually chartered to be self-sufficient. So among the powers of the post office is to establish postal rates and to operate as a business in so many words, despite being a quasi-governmental agency.
Chapter 2. The Post Office Gets a Makeover.
Now in 1970, the Post Office Department, as it was known then, went through a wholesale reorganization as the United States Postal Service, authorized by the Postal Reorganization Act of 1970, proving that we can actually change things in this country if we want to. Since then, it has operated as more of a corporate entity with congressional oversight, but independent of direct government control. Instead, it's overseen by an 11-member Board of Governors, which operates much like a board of directors. The USPS is still expected to be financially self-sustaining, though it has received taxpayer funds in recent years since it began losing money. There is a Postal Regulatory Commission, it's an independent federal agency, that technically oversees the Postal Service, but these agencies have recently kind of been in conflict, especially over the appointment of the current Postmaster General. More on that in a moment. One of the essential services the Postal Service provides is delivery of mail no matter where the destination. It is mandated to ensure that even the most remote of locations in the United States is served. This mandate might be one of the provisions that prevents more talk of privatization, something that occurred in the UK in 2014 with disastrous results. Private equity, such as Goldman Sachs, feasted on the spin-out of the Royal Mail, and almost immediately, prices were hiked across the board and citizens of the UK paid the price, with one writer referring to it as, quote, "selling the family silver," the last vestiges of corporate neoliberalism. So in this way, that federal mandate that there has to be mail delivered to every single part of the country is what's lacking in the digital era. The failure of the US government to classify broadband as a utility from the start meant that rural areas would always be underserved, and concepts like throttling would be permissible. Now, throttling is the ability to kind of dial up or dial back the quality of the broadband access that people get, which is one of the problems in tribal areas and rural parts of the country. Anyway, today, the government has to continually carve out money and regulations to ensure broadband access to remote areas of the country, such as these tribal lands, instead of making providers provide comparable service throughout the nation, as it was when the telephone companies were laying cable. That being said, the Postal Service continues to find itself under fire. Privatization is the least of its worries at the moment, as even Republicans are afraid to touch this third rail, though a few have attempted to chip away certain pieces. The trouble really started brewing about a decade ago when Amazon and private carriers like UPS and FedEx made huge advancements, both spurring and benefiting from the online retail boom. As more and more customers shifted to package deliveries, these entities blew up. And so did the shipping revenue at the post office, mind you, which has deals with companies like Amazon, especially when it comes to last mile fulfillment. But as social media and email continued to proliferate and Google basically ate up the competition for advertising, routine mail and marketing mail began to erode at a startling rate. Now, to be fair, the Postal Service was already running periodic deficits and straining under unfunded mandates, depreciated physical assets, and pension obligations long before Jeff Bezos was emperor of the universe. Financial pressures and a massive bureaucracy led to the reorganization in 1970. And it did work for a time, allowing the Postal Service to pursue efficiency measures and increase prices more easily. So long as it maintained its charge to service the entire nation, Congress was willing to give it breathing room to act more autonomously. The single biggest contributor to the USPS structural deficit that defenders and detractors understand is with respect to USPS pension obligations. Under the reorganization, the Postal Service was required to essentially pre-fund projected retirement benefits. Okay, so projected benefits are always substantially larger than present-day dollar calculations. So the post office was putting away rainy day funds for employees at higher expected rates. Now, that's manageable in the best of times and when you're in a predictable and sustained low interest rate environment. But it meant that the Postal Service would have to be massively profitable to cover present and future obligations. And other federal agencies, by the way, are not held to similar standards. So in fairness to past and present leadership at the USPS, this is an obligation that very few organizations, even the most well-run private companies, would be able to endure over a long period of time and under the best of circumstances. Now, there are occasions when the Postal Service will be the beneficiary of government funds for specific programs. For example, this year, Congress extended funds to provide free service or reduced rates to blind people and overseas voters. The Treasury extended a $10 billion loan under the CARES Act during the pandemic to provide the USPS with liquidity during COVID. Congress also increased the direct funding budget to the Inspector General's office to increase staff and capability for the massive 10-year transformation plan that began under President Donald Trump.
I'm sensing a turning point in our story.
Yeah, just the mere mention of his name.
The Postal Service is a joke because they're handing out packages for Amazon and other internet companies, and every time they bring a package, they lose money on it.
As usual, our nation's orange-hued hero muddies the waters. The post office is not a joke. But Amazon probably does get a favorable deal. When Matt Stoller was at the Open Markets Institute, he did an interview with Vox in which he suggested that there's, quote, likely quite a bit of revenue from Amazon the USPS is failing to capture, end quote. Now, that said, package fulfillment is one of the growing areas for the post office. Now, Trump may or may not have known that, but it didn't matter. The real reason he pinpointed this as a problem was because he hated his coverage in the Washington Post, owned by Jeff Bezos. So 2018 Trump was looking for ways to fuck with Bezos. But it was 2020 Trump that turned his ire to the Postal Service specifically.
Mail-in ballots.
Ooh, of course.
Yep. More people voted by mail-in ballots in 2020 than any other election because of the pandemic. And this is where one of the more interesting characters in our story enters the picture.
Chapter 3. Ode to DeJoy.
Louis DeJoy, a former CEO of a logistics company that sold for more than $600 million, was a bundler for the GOP. All of the major figures in GOP politics have sat before DeJoy on bended knee, looking for funds and support, and he's been a loyal supporter for many, many years. He worked hard for Trump in 2016 and 2020 and was purportedly offered ambassadorships but declined. According to DeJoy and those around him, he was more interested in getting his hands dirty and making a difference. So when the Postmaster General position opened up, he threw his hat into the ring. DeJoy and those around him also claimed that Trump had nothing to do with the selection process and was even surprised that DeJoy would want such a position. Democrats, on the other hand, were suspicious from the start. Now, DeJoy is a hard-scrabble Brooklyn kid who built a fortune in logistics. He still has a deep Brooklyn accent, which is music to my ears, but can be off-putting to some. He's a self-proclaimed operations guy who doesn't bother with details, but focuses on the big picture, a trait that has gotten him into some trouble, like when he testified in front of Congress in 2020 and appeared not to know the rates of anything in the post office outside of a first-class mail stamp. But it was another snap decision that really put DeJoy under a microscope in that same year. Now consider the timing here. In May of 2020, DeJoy issued a mandate after hearing that trucks were running habitually late. From that moment forward, he proclaimed, the trucks were to run on time. And for a while, they did, which DeJoy and his management team celebrated by their own admission. The only problem was that the trucks were leaving facilities without the mail.
Ask and ye shall receive.
It was a fairly big blunder that became seismic in the eyes of Congress and the American people during the height of the pandemic. Not only were postal workers who were considered essential on the front lines of the virus and suffering more significantly as a result, it was becoming increasingly evident that mail-in ballots were going to be crucial in the upcoming election. So DeJoy was immediately accused of sabotaging the election months before it was even held, a claim that would stick to him for a couple of years. On top of that, his wry New York attitude and insistence upon modernizing the USPS to compete head-to-head with UPS and FedEx made it look like DeJoy was nothing more than a corporate downsizing monster doing the bidding of Trump. To many, it looked like his sole mission in life was to destroy the very thing he was put in charge of saving. But DeJoy doubled down. He dismissed his critics and implemented a 10-year turnaround plan to modernize the aging fleet, consolidate USPS facilities, cut back on full-time jobs, and close several sorting centers. The master plan calls for more technology in centralized centers that run in a hub-and-spoke style similar to UPS and FedEx. And by the middle of last year, Republicans and Democrats and members of the public, pretty much anyone with an opinion on the Postal Service, were calling for DeJoy to step down amid complaints of missing mail and slow delivery times across the country. Around the same time, two members of the 11-person Board of Governors stepped down, leaving a vacancy that President Biden has been bizarrely slow to fill. In fact, the administration just put forward their first candidate, former Mayor of Boston and former Labor Department Secretary Marty Walsh, to fill just one of the vacancies. He's currently awaiting confirmation in the Senate. It's almost as though the administration is dragging its heels on purpose, and it might be paying off. Attitudes towards DeJoy on Capitol Hill have begun to thaw, slightly. DeJoy still comes under fire for delays and price hikes, but his willingness to own up to them in hearings has taken the wind out of some of his harshest critics. After it appeared that he was going to ignore calls to electrify the aging fleet and gave an early contract to a notoriously anti-union manufacturer, DeJoy has begun to spread the wealth and work more closely with union shops and has made strides in electrifying the fleet. But the biggest stay of execution for him was delivered in the bipartisan Postal Service Reform Act of 2022. There were two critical provisions among small funding measures and modernization grants that offered tremendous relief to the USPS and might have bought DeJoy some badly needed time to see his plan through. The first is a federal mandate that requires retired postal employees to enroll in Medicare when they become eligible. The second and more important provision is the repeal of the pre-funded benefit mandate. Now, it's estimated that the combined savings for these two measures will save the Postal Service up to $50 billion over 10 years.
Bring it home, Max.
The fiscal year end for the USPS is September. So, fiscal year 2023, numbers that came out as of September, just a few months ago, the U.S. Postal Service lost $6.5 billion. Now, the prior year, it recorded positive net income of $56 billion, but that was due primarily to the impact of the Postal Service Reform Act. Now, we're 3 years into the 10-year Delivering for America plan under DeJoy, and the vaunted USPS is still losing money every month. So, if you're really into this story, I would direct you to listen to the most recent meeting of the Board of Governors, during which you'll hear a strident and defensive Roman Martinez defending the 10-year plan and put down those who would criticize the post office. Martinez is DeJoy's right hand and the chairman of the Board of Governors. There's a serious can-do attitude among the USPS leadership, and they've made some massive gains despite the financial losses. But here's the thing. It's all bullshit. The price hikes are going to continue. Sorting centers are going to consolidate and modernize. The fleet will be replaced and electrified. Facilities will close in the name of operational efficiency. Every standard will be measured against market competitors who have zero incentive to satisfy the needs and requirements of those who are the hardest to service, the most remote, the infirmed and the disabled, the elderly, the isolated, those who receive medication through the mail, tribal members forced to reside in forgotten parts of the country, those who stay connected to loved ones in arcane ways because the digital revolution hasn't yet and may never meet them where they are. The Postal Service was designed to meet the needs of the least among us. When it was established, it was impossible to conceive of a time when private logistics companies would compete with this most basic service. And look, I get it. The world has changed. We've changed. We live in a culture of immediacy. Now, it might sound like nostalgia to suggest that we just leave the post office alone. I mean, I was in the newspaper business and for a long time held out hope that people would still want to hold newsprint in their hands, turn pages over a morning cup of coffee, and save issues that were important to them. But those days are over. But mail delivery is as much a right in the way that broadband should have been. There's a reason that while we poke fun at postal workers and complain about the price of a stamp, we also have a 90% plus favorability rating of the post office generally. It's there when you need it. It's a utility and a right. Listen to the language of the Deliver for America plan. Listen to DeJoy. Read the Postal Service Reform Act. They all convey the soothing sounds of corporatism.
Restructured.
Modernized.
Competitive.
Efficient.
Consolidated.
Streamlined.
All of the buzzwords, all of the efficiency initiatives, they're all possible within a government agency setting. Now, I know that's anathema to those who view the world through a corporate lens, but there are meaningful distinctions when it comes to incentives. DeJoy is pursuing the incentive that makes the most sense to his worldview and experience, and it resonates with Congress and the American people. It's profit, and I get it. From its founding, the Postal Service was supposed to be self-sustaining, and it worked for more than 200 years. That's quite a run. But sometimes we hold on to decisions from the past as sacrosanct without considering the circumstances under which these decisions were made. Now think back to our education series or the healthcare series. It was a given that when our nation was formed, education would be seen as a fundamental, though not constitutionally enumerated, right. But the founders had to make hard decisions when the nation was formed. Raise money for the common defense of the nation or educate the masses? They simply didn't have the funds to do both, and the former was a more present threat to the stability of the fledgling nation. So they devised a scheme whereby this right would be conferred through local taxation, a system that worked broadly but left it open to uneven distribution of resources, one that we grapple with to this day. When it was decided that Americans should be given the right to access health care coverage after the Second World War, the federal government faced a similar funding problem. Pay for the war or provide health care? And from Eisenhower forward, the federal government operated under the false premise of balanced budgets and decided that paying for the common defense took priority over the common welfare. And so it provided for the least among us with Medicaid and retirees with Medicare and created a complex system of coverage that relied on the masses being fully employed and coverage through employer-sponsored health insurance. Once again, this led to the uneven distribution of resources due to the vagaries of capitalism as the population exploded and employment became more and more precarious without union protections. And on.
And on.
And on.
And on. Clear the corporate cobwebs from our eyes, and it reveals a much clearer picture. We're not a small and thickly settled population that can be serviced by centralized hub-and-spoke centers for healthcare, education, or even the mail. We're a widely distributed and aging population with disparate access to each of these fundamental services that contribute to the general health and welfare of the nation. We're not the nation we were in 1797 or 1945. We no longer have to cling to the decisions of the past that were made under wartime duress. We can run general health and welfare programs efficiently if we simply decide to. And we can even tap the private sector to leverage certain concepts, ideas, and technology. That's how the internet was born, how all those satellites were launched, how all those pharmaceutical breakthroughs were made. We focus so much on what the private side of public-private partnerships can get out of the taxpayer rather than how we can ameliorate government services through collaboration, learning, and partnership. For those who cry about government bloat, understand that when postal rates go up, it's the lower and middle classes that eat the brunt of the increases. See, the big guys will just write legislation that allows them paperless delivery, and the well-heeled can pay to have medication expedited, their packages delivered, and ACH payments processed online. Understand, this isn't a cry to just return to the way things were. It's a cry to see things for how they are. If the USPS loses money, the government has no other choice but to step in and fill the gap, because it's a constitutionally designed benefit. That means the taxpayer is on the hook for it one way or another. So not only are they bearing the brunt of the losses, they're bearing the brunt of the increases that attempt to minimize the losses. A wholly government-run agency, still accountable to the Congress, would have to adhere to the highest standards of both delivery and efficiency. At present, we have neither. Fully federalize the Postal Service, and we'll deliver more than just the mail. We'll deliver on a most basic promise. Here endeth the lesson.
It's the end of the episode where we used to do show notes. Now we just talk through a few things. Reflect on what was said or what we should have done instead. Oh, post-show musings.
Hey, folks. Welcome into post-show musings. 99, how you doing?
How you do?
How do?
How do?
How you doing?
I'm a little congested. Sorry, everyone.
I'm sorry about that.
It's okay. I just feel bad I sound like this.
You think it's allergies?
I don't know. I feel fine, so I'm just pretending it's not here.
Okay.
Is that responsible?
I think so.
Okay.
I think so. So I think, don't quote me on this, and I'm going out on a limb, but I want to say climate change is real.
I think so, yes.
Okay. Cool. What else?
This episode was brought to you by Stamps.com. Oh. Never go to the post office again.
That would actually be pretty good. I would accept that.
Yeah, they sponsor every podcast.
They
so
do. I should reach out.
It would not be hard to get a sponsorship.
That's so true. Yeah, no, big fan of the post office. You know, it's not funny, but interesting is where I had this on the board. This is one of those early, this is as early as PBM is unfucking the postal service because I just had so many
acronyms.
Yes. And I just put it on the back burner. I hadn't thought about it for a while. I remember following the DeJoy appointment kind of marginally. I was like, oh, this fucking guy. And I just dismissed it. But I started collecting articles and now I've been going back through them. But if you remember, it was about a year ago. You remember we just weren't getting the fucking mail at our old location?
I mean, that happens to us so often, but yes. I do remember the really bad time, but it also happened a lot of times.
So there's two things there. One was we were in a building that had a really good carrier. Her name is Kathy. She was fucking awesome. And she retired right after COVID. And then
she's like, I've had enough.
Yeah, clearly. And then everything, it was so bad. And so we used to go down to the depot and they'd be like, yeah, we're training somebody new. We'd go down a couple months later. They'd be like, yeah, we're training somebody new. Like they just couldn't hold anybody in the position that serviced the area that we were in. When Kathy was on the route, everything worked like a clock, like a Swiss clock. It was amazing. And then they just couldn't get their shit together. Then it sort of evened out for a little bit. But I remember, and our friend who shares the office with us would remember very, very distinctly, there were weeks we didn't get mail. And we're still a business. Our day job business is one that kind of really needs the mail still. Mm. Like, I would say that of our collection, of our revenue base, more than half of it still comes in checks. We got to open the mail. We got to have a place to open the mail and get anyway. And I was panicked at the time. I wasn't thinking specifically about this episode and about all the articles that I'd accumulated, but I was Googling what the fuck is going on with the post office and just finding all this stuff out and how it all happened and why it was going on really kind of helped put me back in that place and clear my mind. We're so used to shitting on the post office and we're so used to making fun of postal workers and quote government employees. And I think everybody has an example of like, oh my God, I went to the post office that day. What a fucking miserable experience that was. We all have it, right?
Well, I mean, I don't know if you ever go to the post office and have a positive experience.
So where we are now, I've had many.
I went there. It wasn't anything to write home about. It was unintended.
It's not incredible, but like passport applications. I happen to know a couple of the postal workers there. So
cronyism.
What? I didn't appoint them.
Well, I'm saying you're getting special treatment because you're buds.
They were just nice. They were just nice.
The only positive.
They did not solve the problem that I had when I went there, mind you. But
the only positive experience I had was like upstate New York, where there was like four people in the whole town. So they had nothing else to do. They were super nice there.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair. There's a place where my family and I go on vacation with the cutest little post office. It's open like an hour a day. It's just freaking adorable. But I wanted to make sure that this was more than nostalgia and sentiment. Like, there's a real practical mission here, thinking about medicines, thinking about rural areas, thinking about older people that just can't participate in this new digital economy. Like, there has to be a transition period. We should be working harder now to reach those people instead of making it more difficult.
Yeah. I mean, places where there's like food deserts, mm-hmm. or just deserts, period, where they can't get things and they have to order things online.
Yeah.
What happens if they just can't? And for what it's worth, I don't feel like it's a common trope, at least in my life, to make fun of the postal workers. It's more just the establishment.
Do you think that, I wonder if that's a generational thing?
It might be, because like, I just think of like, hero is a strong word, but like, they're kind of heroes in their own way.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. Okay. I don't know. We don't really, I don't think, at least I personally don't have any baggage, except the ones who work in the post office. Because it's like going to the DMV. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, mm-hmm. I don't blame you because I don't want to work here either because it's terrible in here.
Yeah.
So, but the people who carry my mail have always been nice.
But the whole going postal trope, I think, was such a big part of
it. Isn't that based off an actual story?
Maybe it's like an 80s or 90s. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, that's no different than drinking the Kool-Aid. Like, I don't find going postal as a reflection of post officers, more so as a meme of a cultural event.
Okay.
Like, you know, drinking the Kool-Aid isn't about Jim Jones. It's just about, you know,
becoming
indoctrinated by something. So at least that's how I view it.
Yeah, I think mail carriers, maybe it's a generational thing with like, you know, Cliff Clavin was so present in our lives. And then
I don't know who that is.
See, there you go. Newman.
I know who
you know
is,
right? Yeah. They were just like caricatures and they were derided. And
there's a mailman in Hey Arnold and he has like a little song. He's like, I hate the snow. I hate the snow. There's that guy.
I hate the snow.
He does.
Sing it again.
I hate the snow. I hate the snow. Because he's walking in the snow.
Okay. We're going to cut it off. We're not going to blather for too much longer. We have some stuff to get to. But I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I enjoy putting it together on fuckers. What else do we need them to know about? For members, we're going to be announcing when the next hang is. So we'll get that out specifically in the email. If you have not signed up for our free fucking newsletter, I don't know what you're waiting for. The newsletter is amazing. So, you know, it's a
modesty.
Yeah. Rather modest statement and population of one making that claim. But we have thousands of people getting the email now. Listening to this and you're still not getting it, you should.
It's a letter.
Hey.
It's just an e-letter.
It's an e-letter. And we still use the post office to send our stickers out to the members.
Why don't people call them e-letters? It's like we don't have another word for them.
Mm. Yeah.
Weird.
Emails?
No. I've never heard of that.
No.
E-letter.
Emails was vaguely familiar, but yeah. Well, let's start calling them e-letters.
I think we should.
Okay. So that's what we got. Sign up for the newsletter on Fuckers. Make it happen. And for those of you that got your sticker pack in the mail, you should have those Bakunin stickers in hand. We've seen some pictures of Bakunin out in the wild now, but I want to see more. So let's go. Let's get after it.
And the June ones will be here whenever they will be here.
Yeah. Everybody's pretty chill about it.
Yeah. Sorry. Sometimes it takes a while to design them.
Yeah. You got to let the creative juices flow. It's worth the wait. So that's it. Thank you, Manny. Thank you, Unfuckers. Thank you, everybody. And we'll catch you on the flip side.
Bye.